Today is February 6th, and it's Monday night, Church Israel, learning Parshat HaShavua. And tonight we're going to do as promised, which is that I said that once in a while, instead of focusing just on the simple, straightforward meaning of the verses of the Torah portion, we'll sometimes look at Hasidic insights into the Torah portion through either the Mea Shiloach or the Sfat Emet, two Hasidic works that we mentioned in the past. In this week's Parsha, which is Parshat Yitro, the Parsha that includes the giving of the Ten Commandments, appears what is to me the most beloved drasha, the most beloved piece in the work called the Mei Shiloach, that Hasidic work we've looked at, and I can't but focus on it tonight. However, I realized as I was preparing that we probably saw this piece in this framework in the past. I think that in one of the parshiot in the book of Genesis, Parshat Vayetze, we looked at some Hasidic insight, and I think in that context I brought what I'm about to bring tonight, so many of you saw it already, but don't worry, it's so important, it's really good to see it again, but more than that, we're going to use it as a jumping off point to see two other authors. One is the Ramban Nachmanides, who wrote a great, famous commentary on the Torah, and the works of Rav Avram Yitzhak HaKohen Kuk, who we've mentioned before, the first chief rabbi of the reconstituted Jewish settlement, the land of Israel, in the 20th century. Here we go. So the first page has the Mea Shiloach on it, Rav Mordechai Yosef of Izbitra, that's the Mea Shiloach. And all we have to do is take a glimpse of the verse in the Torah that he's looking at, and not more than a verse, because it's really not about the verse, it's about his, what he wants to say. But we'll look at just one verse. It's the first verse of the Ten Commandments. I remember exactly how I taught this. This was 2 months ago we saw this. I wrote on the board over there, and I did a little skit walking in the door, I think, and raving, if you remember. It'll come back to you. So anyway, this week's Torah portion, Parshat Yitro, chapter 20 of the book of Exodus. Chapter 20. The Parsha begins in chapter 18, and chapter 20, the first two verses, the beginning of the Ten Commandments, say, God spoke all these words, saying, I, the Lord, am your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods beside me. You shall not make for yourself a sculptured image, etc. That's all we have to look at. But we have to know that in Hebrew, the first word of verse 2, I...
I'm sorry for interrupting, Rav Schlesinger. This is Valley.
Nice to meet you.
Hi.
You welcome.
You recommended she was, so she had found her way to another class.
Okay.
Sorry.
Directing you to the.
Nice
directing.
To meet you.
Good evening.
Great.
And hello, Deanne. Thank you, Rabbi Glickman. So.
Thank you.
The first word of the second verse of chapter 20, I. The word in Hebrew is Anochi. Coming back to anyone? We talked about this. No, good. So, I don't have a marker. Yes, I do. The word in Hebrew that is used to introduce God is Anochi. And to write that in black letters, Anochi. Right. Anochi, I, the Lord your God. But we have to know that the more common Hebrew word for the word I is ani. Right? To write that in, again, stripped and block letters, ani. And there's no difference in meaning between these two words. You can say ani, you can say anochi. In modern Hebrew, anochi is more literary, more highfalutin, but they mean the same thing. So what's the difference between them? There's no real difference, but there's a difference in spelling. The difference is one letter. We can ignore the vav, because that's a vowel, right? And the truth is, if we just write it with a dot there, indicate anochi, the O sound. we're really talking about four consonants in the word Anochi and three consonants in the word Ani. And the difference, of course, is that this one consonant, the Chaf, Cha sound, is missing in the form Ani. This was Ani, this is Ah, Nochi, the Chaf. So what's the big deal about the Chaf? So in Hebrew language, there are a number of letters that can serve as independent words. In English, we have the, right? That's not a... It's three letters. In Hebrew, the is just one letter, ha, right? The hey that comes as a suffix to a word. Another letter that serves as a word, as a prefix before a word, is chaf. That same letter that is added to the word ani to make it anochi. And the chaf as a prefix, had it been at the beginning of the word, would mean approximately, about, kind of, almost. And therefore, from a spiritualistic point of view, a Hasidic point of view, if we want to find meaning, why does the Torah use the word Anochi and not the word Ani? Where does it add that extra chaf? So our author is going to say it's as if the Torah is saying that it's Ki Ani. It's Ani with the addition of the chaf, cha, which means almost, kind of, like, approximately, as if God is saying, almost, I'm the Lord your God. Kind of, I'm the Lord your God. Approximately, I'm the Lord your God. Is this coming back to anyone now?
Vaguely.
Okay.
You did say it one other time.
Say it again?
You did go over this one other time.
Okay, so it's coming back to someone. With that information, we can read the words of the Meir Shiloach. So you have it here in English. As I've mentioned in the past, the translation, the only available translation into English of the Meir Shiloach, is a terrible translation. And that's why in the right-hand margin, I have written my own translation where I think it should be changed. Wherever I want to change it, I circle the word in English in the text, and I put on the side the word that I circled from the text, and then an arrow to what I think it should be translated as. So, it begins with the word, with the verse, Anuchi Hashem Lokecha, I'm Hashem your God, I'm Lord your God. And he says, the word Ani is not used for Ani, for I. Had it been written Ani, the meaning would have been that the Holy One, blessed be He, had revealed His light to Israel in all its completeness. Right? So this is the revelation at Sinai. God is, as it were, there before the Jewish people and saying, I am the Lord your God. If it had really been written, I, with that simple word, it would as if have been God is revealing Himself completely to the Jewish people. But it doesn't say that. It has the letter Chaf there. The Meir Shiloach goes on to say, and then they could not have searched deeply into His words, for He would have already revealed everything. So what we have here is a fantastic statement of the problematics of full revelation. Had it been that God revealed to the Jewish people Himself all His truth, all there is to know, that would have been a travesty. That would have been a tragedy. Because the result would have been that we would never then be able to search deeply into His words, because we'd know everything already. This is a statement that favors process over result. Everyone thinks, everyone feels, I want to know more, I want to know the truth, and had I known the truth, that would be great. Had I had the full truth of no more to search for, no more to look for, no more to delve into, wow, that would be great, says the author. That would be terrible. That would be the end of religious life as we know it. Because then there would be no movement. There would be no desire, no dream, no hope to learn more, to go into things. There would be no wonderment. There would be no effort. There would be no frustration that leads to further effort. There would be a static perfection. And says our author, as opposed to, for example, Aristotle, that static perfection is a contradiction in terms, because it's not perfection. It's not perfect. From a human point of view, there has to be movement, there has to be development, there has to be process, there has to be the journey. It's fantastic. It's such a deep idea that it has so many implications, and he does it in four sentences. Four sentences. So it's all about the process, the search, the journey. And as it were, he's saying that God did us a great favor by not completely revealing himself, by not giving us all the truth, by leaving us with question marks, making it signposts in a certain direction, but not actually bringing us where we're going, but leaving that for ourselves. And of course, this brings up the idea of partnership between divine and human. He doesn't just give it to us in a silver platter and we have it. Rather, we have to go on a journey, on his journey, on God's journey. He gave us something. We have to do the rest. It's a cooperative effort. I love it. It's fantastic. A whole worldview is contained here, as it were, in one letter, the letter Chaf. So then he says, basically already explained, however, the additional letter Chaf in Anochi teaches that it is not in a state of completeness, yet rather a hint or a shadow of the light that the Holy One, blessed be He, would reveal in the future. Of course, light is a metaphor for enlightenment, for knowledge, for understanding. And there's a lot more knowledge to be gained and to be given that we don't have yet. Now, like, this is just so different than what people who consider themselves to be religious say about the Torah. The Torah is the whole truth. He says it couldn't be, because it were, there'd be no purpose to life. The great truth of the Torah is that it's not the whole truth. But that's a little bit more nuanced. We'll get into as he goes on. The more a man apprehends in the depths of the Torah, the more you go deeper and deeper, you journey further, you discover more, the more he will then understand that until now he was in darkness. You know, you have that feeling, you learn something new. How did I get by without knowing that? What was I thinking yesterday? What was I thinking 10 years ago? How much darkness was I stumbling in, and now I understand? But of course, if it's possible that 5 years ago I was in darkness and now I understand, then the obvious conclusion is that what I understand today is really darkness compared to what I understand tomorrow. That's his next line. This is hinted at in the night and day, as if to say the very structure of the universe, that night follows day and day follows night, is a metaphor to teach you a spiritual, intellectual lesson. What's the lesson? Day means that the blessed God opens the gates of wisdom for man. Enlightenment. Day symbolizes knowledge. And night means that man should not imagine that he's apprehended all in completeness. For all he has attained is like night in comparison to the day that follows. Great, I live in the daytime. There's light outside. It represents knowledge. But I always know that night follows in this world, which is to teach me always understand that your knowledge, your daytime, should be understood by you really as nighttime, and will be understood for you in the best possible case as nighttime when you get to the next day. When you have more knowledge, you realize yesterday was really night compared to the day that came. And it's always a process of really realizing that yesterday I knew less, today I know more. And that's not to be a source of disillusionment. Why? Until today, I knew nothing. I'm so disappointed with the last 55 years of my life. No. It's a source of great energizement that I know that I'm always going forward. And I always have more to do. There's reason to wake up tomorrow. I don't know all there is to know today. So it goes on forever. And I think that word forever... right, you might say, okay, there'll be an end to it. At some point, I'll reach the full plateau, I'll know everything. No, it's forever. And it's forever not just vis-a-vis my life, it's forever in the progression of human history. It's the very meaning of human history. It's the meaning of religion for the Meshiloah, for our author. That's the meaning of religion. That's the meaning of Judaism, to be on a journey, but never to be there. Because if you're there, you're dead. Paradoxically, full revelation, full truth is not life, it's death. Because full truth means static, lack of movement. Life is about movement. So it goes on forever. And it follows that all is night in the face of the light that the Holy One, blessed be He, will open in the future. We're still here? Mm-hmm. We're all moving forward? Okay. Next paragraph. Now this is really, you have to like hold on to your chairs for the next paragraph. This is why the verse that follows immediately is, do not make any graven image. So let's go back to the verse. I can, you know, it's so short I can read it. You don't have to take the trouble to open up. So we read at the beginning, 15 minutes ago, in the Torah, chapter 20 of Exodus, God spoke all these words saying, I, the Lord, am your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods beside me. You shall not make for yourself a sculptured image or any likeness of what is in the heaven above or the earth below, etc., etc., etc. Now, we would think, and this is the straightforward meaning, when it says, you shall not make for yourself any sculptured image, it's a prohibition against making a sculptured image. That's what it says. Prohibition against making an idol. Making a totem pole, making a statue that you bow down to. Whether if it's a god that looks like a bird, or looks like a fish, or looks like an animal, whatever it might be, that's all forbidden. But our author learns it on another level, completely another level. That when it says, don't make a graven carved image, that's what the JPS translation calls a sculptured image, it means something else. I'll first say to you what he's going to say, and then we'll read it. What he says it means is, don't make an idol out of the Torah. Don't turn the Torah into an idol, into a sculptured image. And he's going to say this by the use of another play on words. And here we're using the root pesel, pe samet lamed, which means a sculptured image, a graven image, a carved image. As a verb, it means to carve, make it into a verb. It's just pesal, means to carve, to mold, to sculpt according to a certain pattern, according to certain measurements. Okay, so what is he going to do with that now? So the Torah says, don't make for yourself a pestle. Don't make a graven image. Don't make a sculptured image. So we'll read it. This is why the verse that follows immediately is, do not make any graven image. On which it is said in the Holy Zohar, since it was first written, carve for yourself two tablets, therefore it says, do not make any carved image. Meaning, do not make another Torah. I'll explain. Don't worry, I'll explain. So, everyone might remember that in the Torah, in the book of Exodus, there's really two givings of the Torah. There's what we call the first tablets, and then there's the second tablets. The first tablets, that's in this week's Torah portion. God says the Ten Commandments, the people are, wow, revelation, that's great. But, and Moses goes up the mountain to get the tablets that have written the Ten Commandments. But when he comes down, what does he encounter? The golden calf. The people went off the path. They did wrong. God is tremendously upset, wants to destroy the people. Moses is really completely in a rage. He breaks the tablets. They're gone now. And thank God, in the end, God reconciles himself with the sin of the people. They repent, and God says, okay, I'm going to give you another chance, calls Moses up to the mountain for a second giving. But this time, it's not that God gives Moses the two tablets with the law written on them, it's that God tells Moses, make for yourself tablets and come up to the mountain, and then we'll inscribe them together, right? So, it says, with the second tablets, God said to Moses, Psol lecha, carve for yourself two tablets. Psol, make, carve two tablets. So God says, carve two tablets, and Moses goes up to the mountain, and with those carved tablets, he and God, as it were, get the writing as it should be on the tablets. He comes down from the mountain, fine. Now that word, psol lecha, carve for yourself, verb, carve, is the same word used in our list of the Ten Commandments right here, when it says, don't make for yourself a carved image, a pesel. So we have here, so the Meshiloach, the author juxtaposes, when it says by us, don't make a carved image, that verb, with what it says later with the second tablet, where it says to Moses, make a carved image. Now there are two different carved images. In our Torah portion says, don't make a carved image, don't make an idol. That's the simple meaning. Don't make a statue. Whereas when God says to Moses, psol, make a carved image, it says make the tablets, just like in the movie, the Ten Commandments, right? But it's the same root. So the Meshiloach first points out what it says in the Holy Zohar, the ancient book of Jewish mysticism. And let's read again what he read, what he copied here in the name of the Zohar. Since it was first written, carve yourself two tablets. It's really written later in the Torah. Carve yourself two tablets. Therefore, it says, do not make any carved image. Meaning, do not make another Torah. So, the Zohar is the first to connect between these two verses. The one that says, carve for yourself, and the one that says, don't carve. And the Zohar says it means, in our Torah portion, when it says, don't make a carved image, it means don't make another Torah. So what does it mean? It means that since the word psol is used for the tablets, God gave us tablets that are called psol, carve for yourself, then here in the Ten Commandments, in our Torah portion, it says, don't make a carved image. The Zohar reads it to say, you have a psol already, don't make another one. There's one Torah, don't make another. Make do with what I gave you. To read, that means reading the commandment in our Torah portion, you shall not make for yourself a sculptured image, means don't make for yourself a copy of the psolecha, of the Ten Commandments, of the Torah. Don't make it in your way. Don't change anything. Don't make another Torah. Okay? That's what the Zohar says. The Meir Shiloach, our author, uses the Zohar to say something slightly different. He uses the foundation of the Zohar, which is that we're making this juxtaposition between what it says concerning Moses, psolecha, make for yourself two tablets, juxtaposing it to what it says in our Torah portion, don't make a carved image. The Meir Shiloach is basing himself on that juxtaposition, but he's learning something slightly different from it. He's learning from it, not that our Torah portion says, don't make for yourself another Torah. He's learning it to say, he says, don't make a carved image. Don't turn the Torah I gave you into a carved image. What does that mean? What does he have in mind? What does it mean, don't turn the Torah I gave you into a carved image?
Don't make an idol.
But what does that mean? Right? What does that mean? Well, we already have a hint because we read the first paragraph. And in the first paragraph, he was talking all about process, all about journey, all about never thinking that you have the whole truth, but knowing that tomorrow there'll be more truth, the next day there'll be more truth. If that's what he said in the first paragraph, then the second paragraph he says, don't make the Torah into a carved image. What he means is, and he's about to flesh this out in the next sentence, don't ever think that the Torah as you understand it today is all there is. When you do that, when you think that the Torah that you've been taught today, the one you've learned today, the one that your rabbis and your teachers taught you, the one that your generation understands to be the Torah, if you turn that into the end-all and be-all, thinking it will never develop, there'll never be a deeper understanding, then what you've done is you've idolized the Torah. You've turned it into an idol. You always have to know the Torah, as we know it, is something fluid. Something that you should understand differently tomorrow. And if you don't understand differently tomorrow, then something's wrong. Something's missing. Because there's always more to learn. So let's just see him say that. This is why the verse that follows immediately is, do not make any graven carved image, on which it is said in the Holy Zohar, since it was first written, carve for yourself two tablets, therefore it says, do not make any carved image, meaning do not make it unto Torah. The word pesel, Carved image means something with definite form and measurement, right? I take the chisel, I carve it out, whether it's tablets or whether it's an idol, it has an image, it looks clear, I know where the nose is, and I know where the head is, and the ears in my image, or if it's the tablets that I carved, I know how Charlton Heston has them formed, that's exactly how it is, it's here and it's not there. No. The word pestle, carved image, means something with definite form and measurement, in a state of completeness with nothing lacking. I'll read on in another few minutes. So don't turn your Torah into that. And that's the connection, he says, between the first commandment and the second. The first commandment is Anuchi. It's approximately me, God says. I'm giving you a guide and a direction and a road to travel, but I'm not giving you the full truth. And now start traveling. That's the first commandment. The second commandment is, now that I put you on the road, I'm telling you, never make the road into a pestle. Never make it into a fixed matter. Never think that you, where you got to, that's all there is to go. There's always further to travel. Which means that if my Judaism becomes rote and is the same thing every day, and I never do differently, and I never think differently, and I never develop, and I never have new ideas and new understandings, but it's all the same, then our author is at least metaphorically accusing me of being an idolater. Right? That's pretty powerful. That's pretty... it's a statement, again, for fluidity and for constant search. And this is true, I think, what he's trying to say is true on the individual level and on the communal level. Right? The community of Jews should always know that the Torah we understand today, as we understand, as we apply it in our generation, it's not the end. It's not the way that it always should be understood. We should be searching for new meanings. And on a personal level, it's certainly true. Every day should be a learning experience, should be a growing experience, should be a developing experience. Never tread water, never run in place. And if you do, it would accuse either the individual or the community of, at least metaphorically, of idolatry. Idolatry of turning our own understanding of today into the full truth. No, but it's only your understanding today. I'm reading on. I'll back up and read the sentence again. The word pesel, carved image, means something with definite form and measurement, in a state of completeness, with nothing lacking. And this exists only in the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu. Oh, looks like he just contradicted everything. He told us that the Torah we got is fluid, is moving forward, or to discover new meanings. Never think it's static. And then he says that this state of completeness, nothing lacking, exists only in the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu, but he just said it doesn't exist in the Torah that we got. You hear the problem, the dissonance? So what he means is, there are, again, hold on to your chairs. There are two Torot. There are two Torot. There are two Torahs. Don't hear that and then close your ears, because that sounds kind of heretical. There are two Torot in the following sense. There is the Torah of God that only Moshe Rabbeinu can understand, because his intellect was just about perfect. But at Mount Sinai, we believe that God gave us the Torah, but it's us that heard it. Not God, we heard it. And we heard it on our level, both collectively and individually. So there's a division here between the perfect Torah, the pristine Torah that exists, as it were, only in God's mind and in Moses' mind. But for all intents and purposes, that Torah didn't make it down to the bottom of Mount Sinai. What made it down to Mount Sinai is what we heard of it, what we were able to perceive of it. It's actually like the door, right, on this room that's been here every week. The door that's here every week gave us this room, this little room, and that's the Torah we received at Sinai. Today we see that actually it's much bigger than that. What we see today, that's God's Torah. But we never see that because the door is always there. Now it could be, it should be, that every week the door is moving a little bit furthest. We sing a little bit more. But we never reach the end. So there's always two Torot. The ideal, the perfect, the pristine, on the one hand. And then there's the one that human beings have, until this point, garnered and understood and fathomed. So the human Torah is always getting a little bit closer. Hopefully, if we're going down the path, as we should be, living a little closer to the full divine Torah, but there'll never be a full one-to-one correspondence, because there had there been such a one-to-one correspondence, there'd be no meaning left in living. Good? But I want everyone to be as excited as I am. Yeah. However, for the mortal intellect to fashion something in complete perfection like this is impossible. We can never, in our own minds, fashion it as it really is. On this it is written in a midrash called Ruth Rabbah that Caesar said to Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanina, I too can make a Torah like Moshe. Like taunting the rabbi, what's so great about your Torah? I can make one also. That's what Caesar said. Caesar here is just a word for the Roman ruler. And he decreed, the Roman ruler did, that no fire be kindled for 3 days. Right? You have a Shabbat that you don't kindle fire for 1 day, I can make one you don't kindle fire for 3 days. During this time, he saw smoke rising from a house. It means that the rabbi saw smoke rising from one of the houses where there's supposed to be no fire for 3 days. And Caesar explained to him that a certain government minister was sick and it was necessary to permit the fire to warm up. So in other words, you see immediately that really Caesar couldn't make a Torah with an absolute law. He had to make exceptions. As it were, it's like a car that you have to bring to the garage. It had to be fixed, right? The Torah that Caesar made had to be fixed. And then the author, our author, Rabbi Mordechai Lina, the Meshiloach, says as follows, for indeed, according to our holy Torah, the law is that saving a life supersedes the laws of Shabbat. Yet the difference with us in an example of Caesar is that one who violates Shabbat to save a life is not going against the holy Torah, for thus was it also commanded that saving a life takes precedence over the laws of Shabbat. In other words, the fact that you're allowed to violate Shabbat to save life is not an exception. That's part of the Torah. Okay, so what? What does that have to do with anything? We'll read on. So to in all places where it is a time to do for God, in that very place is also hinted that we should void your law. There's an exegesis there that we won't go into. What he's saying is that the rabbis have the power at certain points when Torah law as it is not serving the purpose it's meant for, the rabbis have the power to change things, to develop things. And the reason he's saying that is as an example of what we're saying, that there's always developments, there's always changes, there's always another level of understanding. And those other levels of understanding, in this particular example, become clear only through changing circumstances. When the condition of the Jewish people needs or demands a change, it could be possible that the rabbis of the generation have the authority, the responsibility, the right, and the obligation to find in the Torah a new understanding that will help the Torah's purpose be accomplished in changing circumstances. Again, the idea of going back to the same idea of development, of looking to the Torah and finding new possibilities. And then he explains everything we just said. He says, therefore, the Torah includes all the possible combinations of events that may occur. Now, the word events is not good. It means all the possible combinations of development that may occur. And its light surrounds all the possibilities and all the experiences may evolve, and it's not in the power of any man to do this. In other words, same idea again. The Torah here, he means the divine Torah, the ultimate Torah, the absolute Torah, it has within it, in a latent sense, things we haven't yet discovered, and as situations and circumstances change in every generation, the Jewish people will discover in that Torah new things we didn't see yesterday, and we'll apply them as fit to changing circumstances. Again, the same journey. He doesn't mean here, of course, to abrogate the halachic process. He doesn't mean that every Jew can look in the Torah and find new things. Maybe he's not a radical anarchist. But he's saying, here, the collective wisdom of the Jewish people, through the rabbis, they will always discover new insights and new ways and new understandings, and that's part of the journey, that's part of what's supposed to be, and we should understand that those new understandings and those new insights are in a certain sense already there, right? They're in the divine, pristine Torah, we just never saw them yet. But each generation, we flesh them out. Just to give an example, not in the area of halacha, but in the area of understanding, we had a class in this room 3 weeks ago, I think, in which we studied the matter of the daughter of Paro. Remember the daughter of Paro, those of you here? And I think that you remember my excitement that I said I'd never seen this before, never taught this before, and it was so amazing to discover new things in the words of the Torah. And perhaps I said it then, if not, I'll say it now. It's continually amazing to me that the Bible has been the bestseller for so many thousands of years, but still, in our generation, scholars, rabbis, and laymen, and me, and us, discover things that previous generations didn't see. How could it be? The Rambam studied the Torah, and Rashi studied the Torah, and the rabbis of generations before that studied the Torah, and they didn't see, quote-unquote, didn't see what we, quote-unquote, saw. How could that be? So you can understand, of course, you can explain it culturally and anthropologically, that each generation understands through its own lenses and its own culture, it's all true. But what you have here is a book that each generation sees their new things. And that's not a tragedy, not a travesty, it's rather the opposite. It's a blessing. Perhaps I told you the story that Rashi, the most famous Bible commentator of all of Jewish history, had no sons but a number of daughters. And one of his daughters had a son, Rashi's grandson, who was Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, called the Rashbam. And just like the Rashbam's grandfather, Rashi, wrote a commentary on the Torah, so the Rashbam, the grandson, wrote a commentary on the Torah. And in the book of Genesis, in the Rashbam's commentary on the Torah, he writes, I think it's chapter 26 in Genesis, that I took this interpretation that I wrote and I brought it to my grandfather, Rashi, and I showed it to him. I said, mine is better than yours, I said to him. And the Rashbam says that my grandfather said to me, you're right. And had I had the time, I'd read a new commentary according to the Pshatim HaMitchadshim B'chol Yom, according to the interpretations that reveal themselves in each generation. There's always new understandings.
So, would this apply to the Orthodox part of Judaism trying to keep things fairly stable? Would this cast a light that maybe others who are pushing barriers have more rights than maybe the Orthodox want to give them, by your interpretation?
The Meir Shiloach, what we're reading now, was known to be a radical thinker, and certainly his words are seen to be edgy and problematic in traditional circles. I think I once told the story that until the 1970s, not too many books of his were sold. It's only since Rabbi Shlomo Karbach in the 1970s made it famous that thousands of Jews now learn the Meir Shiloach. But certainly his words are considered to be, and have been considered to be, edgy. He is certainly here reminding us, right, and goading us to think for ourselves and discover new insights and understand that things are always changing and they should be changing, and that changing is conforming more and more to the ultimate divine light. And he himself is not an anarchist, right? He the story always goes that at the beginning of the Shulchan Aruch, there's a halakha that you're supposed to put your right shoe on before your left shoe. And after you put your right shoe on, you don't tie it, but you put your left shoe on. And after you put your left shoe on, you tie your right shoe, and then you tie your left shoe. And that halakha, which is there in the Shulchan Aruch, is clearly in the Shulchan Aruch, so it's important, but it's not the most earth-shattering halakha in the world. Right? There are more important things, more essential things in Judaism than putting your shoes on in the right order. I didn't denigrate the halakha, but there's certainly a scale of values. But the story goes that once when Rav Mordechai Liner, the Meshulach, put his shoes on in the wrong order one morning, mistakenly, he fasted the whole day for his sin. So he's not an anarchist. He follows the halakha. Right? He's not trying to take everything apart. But on an individual level of always discovering new insights, he's telling us to keep searching for new things. And if we apply what he says, perhaps more broadly than he would apply it, but we have the right to do that. We have the words. We have to see what they mean to us. It certainly does make certain orthodox thinkers a little bit uncomfortable. Absolutely.
How do you distinguish between finding new insights and a new novice misinterpreting things? I mean, how do you get to the level that, because anyone could come in and say, well, I think that means that, at which point?
Great question. Great question. And great questions have no clear answers. But, and I have to tell you the truth, that I have been accused of misinterpreting the Meshulah. I've been accused of being a novice who doesn't understand what he's saying. Absolutely. But be that as it may, I'm trying to be faithful to what I learned from my teachers. Of course, my teachers also being accused of of being novices that don't understand what he really meant. Because how could he mean what you just said he meant? But he seems to mean what he seems to mean. Again, there's no hard and fast rule. But you have to know the language. You have to be steeped in tradition. You have to understand all the rules of grammar. You have to know something about other things that he wrote. And you have to have responsibility, sense of responsibility, and honesty, a sense that I'm not trying to read into the text what I want, but rather reading out of the text what the text wants me to see. You have the same tension in all literature, right? Does the reader read out of the text or read into the text? And we have to be as careful as we can. But on the other hand, according to the Meshulach, we cannot abrogate our responsibility to look in the text for new insights. It's not a bad thing, at least according to what I understand, what I learned from my teacher, it's not a bad thing to search for novelty. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. Because if you don't find novelty, you haven't discovered what you're supposed to discover for that day. If you don't search for novelty, you're letting the Torah tread water. And it's not supposed to tread water. It was given to us anochi, partially, in order to find more. You're supposed to look for new things. And again, when I say that sentence, you're supposed to look for new things, I know many rabbis, primarily Orthodox, who tell me I'm wrong. But that's what he seems to say to me. And that's what my teachers taught me.
What size following would you say he had at the time, you know, the rabbi?
10?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
10. But
4. I've been there with him.
We don't know. But we do know that the followers of the Meshulach were a small number. And they were considered to be a little bit edgy.
I like
edgy. Again, not edgy in the sense of putting their shoes on in the wrong order.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They follow the halakha.
Right. That's okay.
Okay.
What is it? Do you have an example of something that they would have found a novelty that the mainstream would not have?
In halakha? No, I don't have an example. There might not be an example.
Outside of halakha.
But outside of halakha, The very interpretation we just read. But learning that letter chaf.
Okay, but is this more of an intellectual level or a way that you live your life?
It's an intellectual level, and it's a way that you live your life, not in the sense of specific actions. I believe they did all the actions that every other Jew did at that time. But it's an orientation to life. It's an orientation to life, I think. And it's an orientation that the Meir Shiloach got from his Rebbe, who was the Rebbe Mikotsk, if you had heard of the Kotzke Rebbe. He got it from his Rebbe, the Rebbe Mikotsk. Got it from his Rebbe, Rebbe Simcha Boni Mipushitska, who was basically the founder of Polish Hasidut. And it went from Rabbi Simcha Bonim to the Kotzke Rebbe to the Meir Shiloach. And the Meir Shiloach's continuation goes in two directions. You have, on the one hand, Rabbi Tzaduk HaKohen Lublin, Rabbi Tzaduk HaKohen from the city of Lublin in Poland. That's one direction it goes in. And then you have the Sfat Emet, the Rebbe Migur, who's the other offshoot of the Meir Shiloach. The Ger HaSidut, right? The Ger Hasidim, they are based on the same principles, but it's a little bit toned down. Whereas the Rabbi Tzaddik Kohen Milublin really is tremendously creative and astounding, just like his Rebbe, the Izbitcher, the Sfat Emet. Where this is just supposed to be the introduction, right? Let's go on. So we just have a few more sentences at the bottom. So I'm reading about seven sentences from the bottom. Therefore, the Torah includes all the possible combinations of, it says events, that's not a good translation, all the combinations of possibilities and interpretations that may occur. And its light surrounds all the possibilities, all the experiences may evolve, and it's not in the power of any man to do this. It's all there. No man can create a Torah that has so many different possibilities of future development. This is the explanation of the Holy Zohar, going back to the foundational work of Jewish mysticism, that do not make a carved form, going back to our Torah portion, do not make a sculptured image, meaning positive commandments, and any image, right? Do not make any image the prohibitive commandments, the negative commandments. For nothing is revealed to man in its absolute fullness. In other words, the Zohar says, when our Torah portion says, do not make a sculptured image or any likeness or any picture of what's in the world, it means do not make a sculptured image. That means the positive commandments, do not make any carved form. That means the negative commandments. Again, this, don't turn the commandments into an idol. Don't turn the commandments into an idol. Understand that what we understand today is nighttime compared to what will be understood tomorrow. He's just repeating what he says. We never understand everything completely. Okay. So to me, and of course, one of the reasons I love this so much is because it fits into my personal ideology. Not just that it fits into it, but it helped me develop my personal ideology. One of the main points here is a matter of humility. In that I know that what I know is beautiful, but it's night compared to tomorrow's light. And I find, personally, that in denominational Judaism today, there's a lot of arrogance. I think as far as I can see, I know arrogance in the Orthodox movement, I know arrogance in the Reform movement. Perhaps I know less in conservative Judaism, it's in the middle. But
don't worry, it's there too. Yeah.
And each movement thinks that they have all the truth. And the others, the Orthodox think the Reform are destroying Judaism, and the Reform think that the Orthodox are destroying Judaism, just destroying it in different ways. Everyone thinks the others are destroying Judaism. And the Mishloach teaches us to be a little bit humble about it, to be a little bit respectful of others who have different interpretations.
Is that what this says?
That's what I say it says. The whole thing.
Well, I understand, but I think that what with taking what Fred said, I mean, I don't think this is a passage that would be interpreted by the Reformed to justify the way they live, the way they...
Well, no, I didn't say that.
Right.
I didn't say that, but I'm saying that when I read him telling us that any truth I have is partial and contingent, that teaches me humility.
So it could mean that the way that the Reformed have interpreted the Torah is correct.
It could mean there's something to it. There's something to take into account there. And I would hope, of course, this is a dream for the days of the Messiah, but I would hope that all of our three movements would have a little bit of humility and less arrogance, that my way is the only way.
Could also speak to what's happening in Israel today.
Of course. Of course.
It is the extreme.
Arrogance. Yeah. Yeah. Everyone thinks they have truth in their back pocket.
To the point of violence.
To the point of violence. Yeah. Ah, but what's the alternative? Does humility mean relativism? I have my truth, you have your truth, we're all okay, and we'll just live together. That's not such a good solution. Does it mean that I'm not supposed to believe in what I believe in, not fight for what I believe in, not teach it to my children, not preach it to my students? And then you come to the question, how do you maintain humility and open-mindedness and combine it with fervor and conviction and dedication? Right, that's the issue. That's the stumbling block. And if we had two more hours, we'd see that in the source I brought, there might be a certain solution here. So here we go. Yeah,
to
course.
Your point of being of humility, that's what's in the Amidah towards the end.
Remind me?
Every day. I mean, every day we...
The very end, you mean?
Towards the very end, it talks about being humble.
You're right. But we never apply it on those things that are really important to us, on those things we really think we have the only truth.
Okay, but I'm just meaning that.
Yeah.
Every day, it's
yeah.
There's just no, just words.
Okay, let's read on a little bit and apply this. So I brought here the words on the back of the page of Nachmanides. Nachmanides is the Ramban, which is an acronym for Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, and he's in the 13th century, the 1200s in Spain. He has his commentary on the Torah, and this is the introduction to his commentary on the Torah. And he says, the reason for the Torah being written in this form, namely the third person, that it says Moses said and Moses did, and if we believe that Moses wrote it, how can he say about himself, Moses? Should have said, I said, and God said to me, not God said to Moses, is that it preceded the creation of the world. And needless to say, it preceded the birth of Moses, our teacher. So the reason it doesn't say that I said, but it says Moses said, because it was created, as it were, before Moses was born. And it's predicting what's going to happen, as it were. It has been transmitted to us by tradition that the Torah was written with letters of black fire upon a background of white fire. Whatever that means. Thus Moses was like a scribe who copies from an ancient book, and therefore he wrote anonymously. He was just copying what it says. He wasn't creating it. We have yet another mystic tradition that the whole Torah is comprised of names of the Holy One, blessed be He. And that the letters of the words separate themselves into divine names when divided in a different manner. You know what I'm saying? It's to say the whole Torah, of course, is a string of letters. It's divided into words. But take away the spaces between the words and just look at it as a string of letters. You can understand it as we understand it today with this division into words, what it says. In the beginning, God created such and such. And Avram walked here and Avram walked there. But he claims you can divide it differently. The same order of letters, but divided differently, so it makes up a string of divine names from beginning to end. And he gives an example. As you may imagine, by way of example, that the verse of Bereshit of Genesis divides itself into these other words, Berosh Yitbereh Elohim. Right? We read it, Bereshit Bara Elohim. You can read it differently, divide up differently, and it makes sense also. Just for example. This principle applies likewise to the entire Torah. It would appear that the Torah written with letters of black fire upon a background of white fire was in this form we have mentioned, just a string of divine names without any spaces between the letters. namely that the writing was contiguous, without break of words, which made it possible for it to be read by way of divine names, and also by way of our normal reading, which makes explicit the Torah and the commandments. It was given to Moses, our teacher, using the division of words which expresses the commandment, and orally was transmitted to him in the rendition, which consists of the divine names. So you ask me, what is this mystical stuff connected to what we're learning tonight? But it's deeply connected, because the Ramban brings forth for us this Kabbalistic idea that there's really two Torahs. There's a pristine Torah that's written in black fire and white fire. It's just a string of divine names. It's completely other, transcendent, holy, and incomprehensible to us. Whereas the Torah that we got, the Torah that we understand, is the same letters in the same order, but it has different meaning because it's divided up differently into words, and we read it as descriptions of historical events and commandments and advice for life. But the Torah as we read it is only one possible rendering of those same letters. In a certain sense, it's a more earthly, more corporal rendering, whereas the ultimate rendering is just about God's name. It's just about the ultimate truth. So this might be one of the inspirations is what we read in the Me'a Shiloach half an hour ago. Because the Me'a Shiloach, we said, is implicitly talking about, he said it clearly, about two, the concept of two Torahs, the divine one, the ultimate one, and then the one that is a reflection of our understanding at any given point in human history. So it could be, again, the Me'a Shiloach is drawing from this Kabbalistic idea that's brought in the Ramban. Do you see the connection I'm making? Should I say it again?
What time frame is the Me'a Shiloach?
Good question. The Me'a Shiloach is about 1850 to 1880. And the Ramban is back in the 1200s. And so it's already the Kabbalist. The Ramban was a great Kabbalist that brought up this idea that our Torah, the one we have, is a reflection of, a refraction of, but not the ultimate pristine truth that's there in heaven, as it were.
So has anybody ever tried to take the Torah and get the words out of the letters?
I don't know.
Because you're saying it's just a string of letters.
You're right, I don't know.
And someone divided it up into some words.
Well, but
I didn't say someone. I didn't say someone.
You know they have.
Right? I didn't say someone divided. According to the Ramban, God divided it.
Into those words.
Yeah.
That we read today.
Well, yeah, but it's not the only possible division. Right? That's the point. Yeah. So have Kabbalists tried to look for the other divisions? I assume so, but I'm not privy to it. But I can tell you that I've seen this in other Kabbalistic books. It's not just in the Ramban.
Remember, I think it was a data program once where they had somebody come and it was like, you know, every tenth letter, you know.
Oof, I was afraid someone's going to say that. No, this is not the Torah codes,
okay.
Right?
Okay.
This is not discovering predictions of the assassination of this, that, and the other president in the Torah, right? That's not what we're doing.
All right, well, that's why I'm asking that question.
Right.
Just so we get that.
Right.
That's there, too.
But then
perhaps
then to follow what Charles was saying, if it's not obvious, are you saying that there's a lot of divine names we don't know that are divine names?
Yeah.
So that we can't divide it? Or else it would be obvious to divide it, right?
Is that beyond our scope?
It's almost by definition that the divine names we don't know. What is a divine name? It's something that's beyond us. It's a picture. Well, let me give an example. Perhaps you've heard me talk about this. And I can feel it in my heart as I'm saying it, as I'm about to say it. You know what I'm going to say? It's hard for me to look anyone in the eye. I'm embarrassed right now. I'm looking at you, and it's hard. Anyone, even someone I know, even Charles. It's hard for me.
It's hard
for me to look anyone directly in the eye.
And
I'm embarrassed. You don't have the same experience as me?
You're embarrassed at what?
I don't know, but I'll try and explain. And perhaps I'm embarrassed because of my theology that I always use this as an explanation for a deep Kabbalistic idea. In Kabbalah, but not only in Kabbalah, the face, someone's face, is a portal to their soul. And within the portal to the soul, the eyes are really the entranceway. I personally, perhaps it's just because I'm such a introvert or insecure person. I am, though. But I can't look you in the eyes. I feel that I'm connecting too deeply, that I'm invading, that I'm seeing something that I'm not supposed to see.
Isn't that what we're supposed to do, is connect?
But it's hard. I find it hard. Perhaps it's just me. I find it hard. I find it embarrassing.
It's like body space, too. Certain people, you have to stay a distance away, and other people, are almost on top of you, and people have different comfort levels.
Yeah.
Sort of.
It just happened to me yesterday. I gave a lecture at the JCC, and a woman came up to me at the end and started talking to me, and she came really close to me, and she was looking at me directly, and on the one hand, I respected what she was doing because she had a great degree of comfort, and it created a sense of closeness. But I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed just by looking at her in the eyes. So perhaps you're not all like me. But anyway, so the idea is that the face is a portal to the soul, and the eyes are a portal into that soul through the face. And another application, another expression of that vehicle of connection, inner connection, is name. Knowing someone's name and using that name. I just like it's hard for me to look at people in the face. It could be one of the reasons that I'm so good at forgetting people's names is because I'm sometimes afraid to use your names because I feel I'm not close enough to be allowed to say your name. I'm telling you the truth of how I feel. I'm just psychoanalyzing myself. And only after I know someone well do I feel the permission to use your name. And in that very sense, the Kabbalah talks about God's name. God's name, what right do you have to say God's name? What right do you have? Do you think you can know God's name? That you can say it? Is he your friend? That's why in Judaism we say Hashem, the name. We don't say God's name. Because to say a name is to connect. And who are you to connect? Who are you? You're not on God's level. So we keep our distance. So the Torah, the real Torah, that's a string of divine names, it's totally transcendent. To say a string of divine names is to say transcendent and other, and not for you. Not for you. And indeed, many of God's names, by definition, we don't know. We can't know. So anyway, back from up there to more mundane things. Does anyone connect to what I'm saying? A little bit. No one else? A little bit? Okay. Don't look
I
at me too directly.
I hear what you're saying, but we're supposed to be God's children, so we're supposed to connect with him. You know what I mean? He's our father. So, I mean, obviously we're going to speak his name. We're his children.
I don't speak my father's name. I always call him daddy.
Ooh, that's such a good point.
I mean,
that's a really good point.
It would be really the bizarrest thing in the world to call him Johnny.
That's my dad's name.
Freak me out. And it would freak him out, and it would disrespectfully.
Right, that in the halakha it says you're not supposed to say your parents' name.
So God's the endearing word for his other names.
Okay. So I want to now take this to Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, the beginning of the 20th century, show how I think he was influenced by the Me'ah Shiloach and influenced by the Ramban and that Kabbalistic idea, and applies it to Judaism in the 20th century. Says Rav Kuk, the next passage here, religion is corrupted by the decline of the higher Torah, through which one gains the recognition of the greatness of God, the higher perfection that is infinite and beyond assessment. Notice that expression, the higher Torah. It's not the Torah we know here on our earth, in our everyday lives. Thus our religion does not yield the noble fruit it ought to yield. It does not raise the souls from, I made a mistake in my translation, from their lowly state and the numbers of those who dishonor it and desecrate it increase. However, the Jewish religion is rooted in the infinite, which transcends every particular content of religion. Let's stop there. So the Jewish religion is rooted in the infinite, and the infinite transcends every particular content of religion. So when he says the infinite, he's referring to God, and he's also referring to that expression in the first line, the higher Torah. There's the infinite God who has the higher Torah, the perfect Torah, that string of divine names. But what we have is the particular content of religion. We have Judaism as expressed in our day and our age, as understood by our tradition up until this point, as understood by the sages, as understood by each individual at this point. That is the particular content of religion. And Rav Kook is extremely perturbed by the fact that we mistake the two. We mistake the particular content of religion for the higher Torah. And we present the particular content of religion, that is to say, what this generation understands as Torah, as developed by the sages up until this time, we present our temporal, current understanding of Judaism as it's developed from time immemorial until today, we present it as the whole thing. And we forget that it's only the particular content of religion. It's not the higher Torah. It's not the infinite. It's not exactly the same as God's perfect Torah. It's the best we can do in our generation. And we have to respect it and keep it and love it and cherish it and fight for it and die for it. But it's still only a shadow of what will come tomorrow and the next day and the next day. And says Rav Kook that when we mistake the current Torah for the higher Torah, what happens is our religion does not yield the noble fruit it ought to yield, line 3. It does not raise the souls from their lowly state, and the numbers of those who dishonor it and desecrate it increase. Why does it happen? Because, for example, to use the example that Charles used, if we tell people, if we tell the secular Jews who are not connected to Torah, that the Torah of today is the Torah, it's the Judaism, it's exactly what God wants, well, they'll look at what's happening in Beit Shemesh and look what's happening in other places and say, if that's your God's Torah, then I don't want it. And the truth is, I don't want it either. But if we understand that the Torah we have today is only a shadow of what it's supposed to be, that it's always growing and increasing, it's always coming closer and closer to the divine values. The divine values are far beyond what we know today. Again, what we have today is the best we can do. We have to respect it and keep it and love it and cherish it and fight for it. But we're always striving for more. And if I tell the quote-unquote secular people who are watching what's happening in Beit Shemesh that what's happening is only the temporary expression, but it's not the full ultimate divine truth, then they have something to buy into, says Rav Kook. Perhaps you'll say he's being naive, etc., etc., etc. But he is so afraid that we're turning the Torah, Rav Kook is afraid we're turning the Torah into a pesel, into a statue, a graven image. And you know what some people call that in the 20s? They call it a fossil. You've heard people say that Judaism has turned into a fossil. It doesn't change, it doesn't develop. It's not responsive. That's what Rav Kook is saying. Again, he's not going to throw out the baby with the bathwater. He's not saying abandon the whole tradition, God forbid. He's not saying interrupt halachic continuity. But he's saying we have to be humble about what we have today and strive to grow it towards the ultimate divine truth. And not be satisfied that the way it expresses itself is the highest divine expression as possible.
But the divine Torah that's up there, the string of divine names, it's not absolute. It is
absolute.
It's absolute now?
No, the one that's up there. The one that's up there is absolute. And we're striving to take the Torah we know and get it a little bit closer, a little bit closer, a little bit closer to the absolute, full, ultimate Torah. And it's a constant journey.
Which is already there.
which is always as if to say
we don't know what it is,
but every development is an uncovering, right? It's an uncovering, it's an unearthing of those deeper layers.
Okay, I'm trying to come to a little bit of a understanding for myself at my own dumbed down level. So on several occasions, including our dinner, you've come up with this overall philosophy. What you're saying tonight is not new. You've said it two or three other times. So the problem I have with it is it's like you create such contradiction, and then you don't leave me the with anything concrete to understand the application. You seem to rip everything apart at the same time saying, but we should honor all this and that and the other thing. So you don't leave me with any new road to sort of travel on other than confusion. So
thank you, Fred.
If at some point, because you've given us the philosophy, you can give us a little bit of a road, that would be helpful to me.
I really appreciate that. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
Actually, I have the exact opposite reaction. Because what I've heard you say is that despite all this conflict among the Jewish people, there's an explanation. It's evolving. It's a temporary. It's not the way it is intended to be. It's a process that we need to seek to improve upon. I understand what it is Fred's saying, because to a certain extent it gives me a headache. I mean, to try to absorb all this and go, okay, now what?
Yeah.
But yet, for the point you raised, when you look to see what's happening in Beit Shemesh or in Mei Shemesh, and what's happening with the stories about young girls and the women, on the one hand, you could look at it and say, forget it, I'm going to become a Baptist.
Right. Right.
And on the other hand,
I didn't hear.
Sorry, I didn't mean any disrespect.
Oh, I'm not
at all. I didn't mean that. I just meant, you know, I'll be something else. I could have said Lutheran.
Right. Right. Yeah, yeah.
Or then on the other hand, it's, well, you know, we're the Jewish people. We're striving. We're trying to reach the infinite, and we don't know when we're there, and we won't know until we look back. But to me, it just helps to explain in a way that maybe it's just a rationalization. Because on the one hand, I read these stories, and I go, just what you said, if that's your God, that ain't mine. If this is your religion, it's not my religion, what am I doing?
Right, right, yeah.
Yeah, but you're not referring just to those type of incidents.
Right.
You're in a much broader sense of what you're trying to bring up, so that's where I have my confusion.
The thing that Fred's struggling with is you go right up to the edge, but you don't quite say it, that if in fact we learn more from about the ultimate Torah, it actually causes halakha to be viewed in different ways and actually move and actually change. And there are those in our religion and in Christianity that have said that the halakha was given for the weak as a guidance on this search.
Yes, I understand.
And the trouble that Fred has, and that I think I have academically, is the failure to admit that halakha does change, and some of it does become fossilized because of things change. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Important things we've just heard. I spent many, many years in yeshiva, right? Many years, and I have within me a deep, deep, deep love and passion for and loyalty to God and Judaism, halakha and Torah. That's something that can't be taught in text, and that's something that's really hard to absorb if you're not in that environment. I just assume that love that I have, but of course I'm wrong to assume it because you haven't been brought up in that environment, and then I come and go off the edge, or near the edge, with all this stuff here. And I understand why it creates a certain degree of confusion, because if you're not grounded totally in the worldview of Judaism, then all this stuff just is confusing. I understand that. I get it. So what can I say? My program is one of constant growth and constant study. And if you ask me what I suggest, Livriut, it's to spend every waking moment learning Torah and be totally absorbed within it out of great love and passion and commitment, with the understanding that just as I study every day and we study every day and we grow, the Torah itself is growing. The Torah itself is like a sapling. At this point, it's not a sapling anymore, it's a tree. But that tree is always growing. And I love the tree as it is. It's the only tree I have. Even though I know tomorrow will look different. And look bigger and better.
But are you saying, when you're saying it's growing, individually to each one of us growing with our understanding toward it? And then how do you compare it to... Like, then how could you say that maybe a reform that doesn't observe the Sabbath... In their mind, it's growing, and you don't have to, you know, certain halacha observe it. I mean, how do you differentiate if it's, you know, your individual?
Hard question, right? When I say the Torah is always growing, mm-hmm. I mean on both levels. My personal understanding is growing, yours is growing, yours is growing. But the Torah itself is growing, as every generation is going to have, collectively, a newer and better understanding. At least that's the way Rav Kook and the Ramban understand, and the Meir Shiloach. It's always, the Torah as we know it today is different than it was 100 years ago, right? If you go back in time to the shtetl, the way it was practiced then is different than the way it's practiced today, and it doesn't matter if you're Reform, Conservative, Orthodox. So, you know, in the Orthodox, it's different today. It's not different black and white, it's the same tree, but it's different.
You're talking about our interpretation, our societal context.
Right, right. When I say the Torah is different, I don't mean these words are different. But what we see and hear and understand when we read the words is different today than it was 100 years ago. Absolutely. No doubt about it. Absolutely, it's different. It's different in a contiguous fashion. Again, it's not a different tree. It's the same tree, but the tree has grown. The tree is always growing. And I have to... it's an axiom that we love the tree, and it's our tree. And the fact that we know that today it's not as big as it's going to be tomorrow doesn't take away from our love for it today. It's the same tree. But of course, I have to be existentially and completely and utterly involved in watering the tree every day. It's my tree. It's our tree together. Right?
But not just watering it, pruning it, and shaping it. So it's not the same tree. It's a different, it's maybe have the same roots. Same roots to which we can be truthful, but back to the issue of the halakha, things have been pruned, they have to be pruned as we get into better understanding. I think that that's the tension, and I'm not disagreeing with you, you know, but I think that's the tension that some in the room might feel, is that we've got to set some of the stuff aside and see it in a different way.
Right, so that's the question of the how. That's the question of the halachic process. We can agree that the tree grows and develops and there are new leaves every day. But then the question is, well, who puts those leaves there and who is the authority and what's the process? Obviously, that's a rather great controversy among different factions within the Jewish family. And I don't mean to express any opinion. I do mean to express an opinion. My opinion is that the process has to be an organic one. That the tree has to grow from its roots and from its trunk. That we don't graft onto it a different tree, right? But within the framework of organic growth, We have to know that it grows, and we have to be part of that growth. But then we'll say, well, what's the definition of organic growth? And we'll get into, again, a discussion. Right. But I think that we could not have that discussion of how it grows, of what constitutes organic growth, at the same time that we can agree that there is organic growth.
Can you give me an example of, for instance, your organic growth in this process of interpretation?
Yes.
Over the last couple of years?
Absolutely. When I first began my teaching career, it just so happened that I was hired by an innovative college in Jerusalem. It was one of the first colleges for advanced Talmudic studies for women. So I merited to be in at the ground floor of the development of female Talmudic study within the traditional framework. And in the past 30 years, it's become normative that women study just as much as men, and even the most advanced Talmudic texts, even within the quote-unquote Orthodox world, something that was not accepted 1,000 years ago and 500 years ago and 100 years ago. And I got to see that organic development within the school I was teaching with, and it was extremely important to the director of the school, who was a woman and still is, that we all understand, and that the Jewish world understands, that this is not a radical innovation, this is an organic development. So what does it mean, organic development? It was about mining the Talmudic texts and showing that they contain within them the possibility, and even under some circumstances the recommendation, that women study on the highest levels as men do. The fact that it wasn't done for thousands of years, okay, it wasn't done. But the halakhic process that took place within the school, and I merited to be part of, was about showing how the Talmudic texts allow and even would encourage, under certain circumstances, to do what we were doing. It was about finding new interpretations within the Torah. And that was on a halakhic level, so it had to be within the halakhic process. It had to be a process of peer review. It had to be a very slow, organic process. But I can say that it was a process that was successful. Because 50 years ago, it was almost unheard of within the Orthodox world that women learned Judaism on a high level, and today, it's almost uncontested. And this has been in the framework of the writing of hundreds of halakhic articles and slow development and reinterpretation of ancient texts within a honest and a sincere a process of trying to find out what the texts say to our generation. That's one example, and to me it's one of the greatest examples.
So implicit with organic growth, don't you think, is change?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So
this is an example of change. But it didn't happen overnight, and it didn't happen through grafting in something external, but by re-examination of those same texts within a halakhic process and framework. So, it's obviously very late, and I'm just going to look and see if there's anything in Rav Kook that we have to read here. Yeah. Okay. The truth is that I think that we covered the subject through a discussion in the best possible fashion, even if we didn't read all the texts. That's fine. Does anyone want to add anything to our discussion? No. Okay, so we said that next week there's no get-together on Monday night, and there's no get-together on Friday night, but we're back here again on Monday the
20th.
Okay.
6 and 14 instead of 6.
Okay. Good. Okay.